Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the hand of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. We're here with James and Kirk. How are you, fellas?
Howdy. Doing good.
Yeah, we need to send Kirk some oxygen. It's a little smoky there in California, particularly in the north. The city is trying to, the state is trying to emulate Dante's version of hell. Yeah. Well, some of the pictures I've seen there. I mean, I don't know how it's possible to have a thing called a fire department and to lose 40 square blocks where there isn't a single house. We're not talking about a block or 40 houses. We're talking about 40 square blocks of some of these towns are just gone. I mean, like, it's not like they, you know, there's some things burned. They've evaporated. They're just far worse than any tornado or hurricane. They're just gone. I look at it and say, how is that possible? How could you have a fire department? And, you know, with the natural breaks of streets and landscape and the like, how do you lose every house in 40 square blocks?
It's pretty strange, isn't it? Well, I don't know whether they
somebody
just
doesn't know what they're doing. I mean, there's got to be some accountability here because it is pretty astonishing. I want to talk about a few things this evening before we get to the back to observations in chapter 14. The first is, do you know what percentage of the heroin that Afghanistan produced under the Taliban?
Almost
10%. Yeah. After the United States invaded Afghanistan and the CIA had direct access to the poppy fields, do you know what percentage of the world's heroin supply Afghanistan supplied?
I'd guess 90%.
Yeah. 90% is the number. Do you know what the biggest health risk right now, the leading cause of death throughout many states currently, the fastest growing epidemic in the United States is?
Opioids.
And they're in the legal form. They're called opioids. Oxycontin is the most popular of them. In the illegal form, that's either heroin or fentanyl. Would you like to hazard a guess what number of Americans were prescribed the drug last year? There's what, 325 million Americans, approximately. What number of Americans do you think were prescribed this deadly painkiller last year?
Well, that's got to be quite a few.
Would you guess?
20%? 25%? Is that too many?
90 million. 90 million. I mean, that's like one in every three adults in the country. In fact, it's more than that. It's between one in every two and every three adults in the country. Isn't that stunning? Is a drug that is deadly, and you've got over 90 million Americans being prescribed this drug. Now, that doesn't count the number of Americans that are taking it illegally as heroin or fentanyl. Well, it's just stunning. So America invades Afghanistan, and the epidemic of heroin, fentanyl, and the opioid addiction becomes our biggest health concern. But it's no wonder that you watch society. People can't think, they can't drive. We have drugged ourselves into oblivion, into a stupor. We're comatose as a nation. And that doesn't include the mind-altering drugs, the antidepressants, the psychiatric drugs. That's just one form of painkiller. Well, why are we in such pain? Well, you and I, we all know the answer. Yeah. One of the things that has just been mind-boggling for me, you know, originally it was one person that bowed at the national anthem, and you know, I won't stand for the national anthem, so I had no problem with Kaepernick not standing for the national anthem. I didn't agree with his reasons for not doing so, but it's irrelevant whether or not I agree with his reasons. The Constitution gives him the freedom to do so, and if anybody wants to gripe about it, then read your goddamn Constitution. You know, the reason I didn't agree with it is that, well, I understand there is some racial profiling amongst police in particular. The racial profiling is deserved. Now, if you don't want to be profiled, don't commit the majority of crime. In majority of crime, disproportionately, per capita is committed by black individuals. So they're profiled for a reason. If you don't want to be profiled, change your behavior. And I don't like the idea of them complaining that Black Lives Matter, that they think that white cops are indiscriminately killing blacks, when the fact is that 9 out of 10 blacks that are murdered are murdered by another black. If you want to protest the killing of blacks, look in the mirror. So I didn't agree with what he was doing. But, you know, a lot now of other teams have players that are protesting. And so it got to the Trumpster's agenda. And the Trumpster is Mr. Patriotism. You will respect the flag of your Führer. You will respect our troops. You will honor them. You will not disrespect either. In fact, he sent the Pinster to a game. You know, big old, probably a 757 U.S. jet. Sent just for Mr. and Mrs. Pence and a handful of gaggle of generals. So they could walk into the Indiana Colts game while they were playing the San Francisco 49ers. And when they put their hand over their heart and stood at attention when the national anthem was being played, and some players on the San Francisco 49ers took a knee, they walked out in disgust and flew home and said they will not be part of any event where someone disrespects our flag, our anthem, and our troops. By the way, why would you respect a military that made a mess out of Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, just to name a few?
Vietnam.
That has caused, what, 5 million refugees? Killed over 1 million people? Destroyed those countries? And we are told you either respect them or we're going to ostracize you? When is it that people are going to begin to think and realize, you know, the national anthem at sporting events is a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, the national anthem as a whole is a new phenomenon, and the song itself is based upon an English drinking song. In fact, a song that actually glorifies drunken orgies. Yahweh is opposed to us showing our allegiance to country. If you're going to be patriotic, you absolutely cannot be saved. You cannot enter heaven. You cannot be part of the covenant. You're not welcome in God's company. So 100% of those who are rallying around the flag, standing with their hand over their heart, the playing of the national anthem, are excluded from heaven. And yet 50% of Americans disapprove of their expressing their right to take a knee at the national anthem. Pretty amazing, isn't it? What do you have a comment on either of those, or am I out on a limb, or do you guys happen to...
No, you're not on a limb. I didn't like the way they took a knee. They should have just walked away or not come out. I mean, a knee, why would... To me, that's like bowing down to it.
How do you do that?
They have absolute right to... If it doesn't do anything for you or me, and we look at it and it's not, they don't represent us, why should I respect them? They don't respect any of my thoughts.
Right.
Yeah, I have a constitutional right to tell them to go jump. Hey, so what?
Well, in today's America, where we are returning to a much more zealous and in-your-face form of America, love it or leave it.
That's the scary part, is it's going to be the criteria.
Yeah. There's a president of one of the stands. Here is the stand. That made some interesting statements about Russia and Islam. I just want to read one of them. It made the national news media. My guess is very few people actually considered it, but it said this. If there is no democracy, then neither the region nor the world will have a bright future. Let me give you one example. There is a big spike of terrorism in the world. Currently, it's Daesh, the Islamic State. But later, it'll be something else. Also Islamic. What's the cause of terrorism? And why only in Muslim countries? Because it is in Muslim countries that the inequality and social injustice is most visible among the people. Because some regimes call themselves republics, but in fact are authoritarian and dictatorial. There is no justice, and there's a wide social gap between rich and poor. In such situations, when ordinary people don't have the opportunity to change anything, to have any hope, when there's no lack of social mobility, then the result is terrorism. Now, what he, of course, left out, but he can't say because his country is 90% Islamic, is that Muhammad was a terrorist, and so all good Muslims are terrorists, according to the Quran. But it's interesting for him to admit that terrorism all comes from Islamic countries. 99.9% of terrorists are Muslims. And that Islamic countries are the worst in terms of social injustice, economic justice, opportunity. Why is that, do you suppose? That the least opportunity and the greatest injustice is in the 55 countries where Islam is the majority.
Well, if you have no
law, what do they have in common?
Toxic religion.
Well, it's religion, of course. Tree of law.
Exactly. As all of you know, I am opposed to Paul. Yahweh is far more opposed to him than I am, and he happens to be God. And so his view is my view, that Paul is the plague of death. About 7 or 8 years ago, I wrote a book called The Great Galatians Debate, about 600 pages, where I began it by trying to explain away Paul's apparent contradictions of Yahweh, particularly of the Torah. And, you know, I got to about page... I got to somewhere in the third chapter of Galatians, which was Paul's first book. It was his rebuttal to the Jerusalem Council. He was called there because of his opposition to the Torah and to circumcision in particular. He wrote that the Torah cannot save. And I looked at his quotation that he used as the basis of it, and it comes from the second chapter of Chabaouk, and it was obvious that he had miscited the quotation, taken out of context, and inferred just the opposite. And a little bit later on, I came to a quote where he said that the covenant that was memorialized on Mount Sinai, which would be the covenant as it's presented in the Torah, the old God's one and only covenant, not only can't save, it enslaves, and that it was based upon Hagar. And you read that and you say, well, you know, there is no resolution for this. In fact, I must have spent a week. I tried to read, and I don't know how many hundreds of Christian apologists try to explain away that portion of Galatians where Paul stated the opposite of what's true. When you state the opposite of what's true and you claim to be speaking for God, you are what's called a false prophet and liar. Mm-hmm. And so I had to go back and I rewrote the book based upon that realization. And not long thereafter, I realized that, you know, I'd only covered about 5% of the evidence against Paul. So I rewrote the book based upon particularly what I learned in Chabaouk, where God calls Shaul out by name and claims he's the Paul of death and the plague of death. And the new version of the book was almost 1,300 pages in length. And now here on observations, and I'll bet that at least a third of observations, which is well over 1,000 pages already, mm-hmm. is directly critical of Paul.
Oh. Yeah.
So as I was writing about this chapter that we have been on, and we were dealing with some of what God had to say, particularly as it relates to the fifth chapter of Yashayah. In fact, this was the last quote from Yashayah. We'll read that. And then I had a reason to actually consider what other people had come to conclude regarding Paul. It begins like this. Whoa, this is a warning to those who take the lead in promoting error by twisting and distorting in a boisterous and agonizing religious parade of error for futility and vanity. Well, you know, of course, that would be Muhammad and Paul first and foremost, Akiba after them. As with the ties that bind on the harness of a cart of sin, of wrongdoing, the one among them says, without thinking and out of anxiety over the future, he should want to hurry. I want him to swoop down and accelerate his work so that we may see it. So then, let that vexing counsel and painful advice, that scheming plan of the Holy One of Israel, approach and present itself, because we want to be made aware and know. Now, when I read that, the second part of that, I said, we're just talking about Paul there. That was Paul's one and only prophecy, where Paul specifically said, hey, I don't want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, that you may not be anxious and fearful, grieving, as do the rest who have no hope. Now, they sell religion. Religion is sold on hope. False hope, but it's sold on hope. For we, if we believe that Iusu died, by the way, God can't die, and rose again, even so, God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Iusun. Yeah. So much for Dode, huh? Too bad that God loved him. He must be gone. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord. By the way, he never quotes the word of the Lord, so I don't know why he thinks he is saying it by the word of the Lord, since he never quotes it. That we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord shall not precede those who have fallen asleep. Oops. We who are alive. We. And he used it, you know, based on the word ego, didn't he? I myself.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking about this. You know, one of the arguments people try and make is that Paul wasn't a prophet, you know, so we can't call him prophet. But if he just said, by the word of the Lord, and this isn't quoting anything else, that means this is a special revelation from him, which would put him in the category of prophet.
Well,
if you can't find this wording anywhere else.
He's predicting a future event.
Mm-hmm.
He's acting. He's saying, I don't want you to be unaware. I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm telling you about the what he would call the rapture, the harpazo. He's predicting what's going to occur. He's acting as a prophet. He's got it wrong. For the Lord himself, by the way, I've just finished. Most amazing experience. I'm goosebumped. It was, in fact, I couldn't even finish the edits of chapter 15 because I was just mesmerized by what I was learning. I had an occasion to study the Canaanite religion. I didn't know that we actually have the Canaanite scriptures. Yeah. You guys know that?
No, sir.
Yeah,
we have the Canaanite scriptures. I read them. I did. I read them. Son of a gun. You know what the Canaanite scriptures describe? I mean, to a T. We're going to get to this in future programs. Christianity. The Canaanite religion is Christianity. And you know who the chief god of the... Well, the old god who's been replaced, his name was God, El. God. But you know who the new and improved God is? The God who dies and is resurrected, the Savior God that replaced God the Father?
Oh. Ooh.
God the Son, and his name is Ha-Bel, the Lord.
Ha-Bel, the Lord. My God.
Oh, my. And so I read
Where
about
did you
this.
Find this?
It has the Queen of Heaven and the Mother of God. It has all of the intrigue. It is the basis of Christianity. And so after I read it, I said, you know, there is a whole chapter that is devoted to a prophet I've never cited anything from. And you know, all the years I've been doing this, I've never cited anything from Elia. Known as Elijah. But the 18th chapter of 1 Malachim, Kings, is devoted to a referendum between Yahweh and the Lord. The entire thing, from beginning to end, it's Yahweh v. the Lord. And the Lord amassed 850 prophets. You know how many prophets existed in the entire world to oppose those 850? You know how many?
Just one against
one. One. Elia was the only prophet of God. The only one on the whole world at the time. And so it is a referendum between Yahweh and the Lord. So I went through and I translated the 18th chapter of 1 Kings. Oh my goodness, I had never seen it so clearly presented as to why God hates religion and the consequence of religion and what religion does to people. And it's quite a treat. But Paul, in fact, spoke on behalf of the Lord. And by the way, God just says unequivocally, you know what I mean? It was kind of interesting, 19th chapter of Kings. Yahweh said, I'm going to spare a remnant of Israel. You guys have any clue how many he spared?
1 in 10?
7,000. That's good. 7,000. So, okay, do you know what his criterion was to spare each of the 7,000? Each of these 7,000 had one thing in common. And only one thing in common.
Trusted him?
Nope. Oh, no, not a single one of them knew him.
Oh, okay.
Not a single, he doesn't say a single one of them knew him. He spared 7,000, not because they knew him, but all 7,000 were spared because they were the only ones in Israel that had not bowed down to the Lord. There were only 7,000.
The only ones that there was any hope for.
Men, women, and children. Men, women, and children who had not bowed down to Baal. That's it. So truth is certainly not be possible. Here's Paul. He's speaking of the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord, if you're speaking on behalf of the Lord, you know what he did to each of the 850 prophets of the Lord at the end of the test?
He's been fired
killed them all.
Yeah.
killed them all. And for those who say, oh, that's that mean, wrathful God of the Old Testament. No, that's the loving, caring God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. If you have
God
people
to get rid of a person
your
children
like a death, you deal with them. That's the most loving and compassionate, moral and rational thing you can possibly do. Now, I made this point as going to the chapter, and I just want to reinforce it here, that we're not God. Not one person on this planet has the authority of Elia to do any of these things. But God made this point so that we might understand how to treat those who are, or how to at least view those who are abusers, so that we might protect and care for the abused and support the abused. Yeah, he killed them all. So, continuing, and by the way, Paul knows that the Lord is Satan. He knows what God said to do to those who promote the Lord. He knows that there's no salvation whatsoever for anybody who addresses God as the Lord. And what did he say? Yeah, I was saying in the Sermon on the Mount, no one who calls me Lord, Lord is going to enter
Lord,
the kingdom of heaven. Go away from me. I don't know you.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, for the Lord himself would ascend from heaven with a shout and with the command of an archangel. Now, what's so amazing here is he's on top of everything else, he's got Teruah and Yom Kippurim screwed up. Now, the reason he doesn't want to talk about Yom Kippurim, that's when Yah is going to return, is Yom Kippurim. And Teruah is the harvest that is coterminous between the treaty that sends Israel at the waste, forced him to give up the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, and the beginning of the Magog War, when Muslims buy the probably hundreds of millions stream into to Israel. And of course, Yom Kippur is when Yahweh returns. These are very different things. Yahweh does not come for us on Teruah. He is not coming for us on Teruah. We are going to him.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge difference.
Yeah.
Yahweh is not coming back to earth until Kippurim. And there's not going to be any great trumpet on Kippurim. He's going to appear like light in the sky, like a constellation of light. So, Paul is really screwed up. I mean, everything he's saying about this is false. The command of the archangel. Why do you think that God's going to be preceded with an archangel? You know, when God was present on earth, like on the top of Mount Horeb and explaining the Torah to the people, did he communicate through an archangel?
No.
Hey,
nope.
God can communicate through an angel. They're not angels, they're malach, they're messengers. Excuse me for using the wrong term. But Yahweh can, you read this garbage that Paul has, and it's terrible what it does to you. But Yahweh can and does communicate through his malach. In fact, there's a number of meetings between malach and Elia. Like one of the malach shows up. And Elia's in this cave, and he says, "What in the world are you doing here? Get up, stand up, get something to eat, have something to drink. You got a big task ahead of you. You need to get going." Basically, you know, kicks him in the butt and say, "Come on." So anyway, you know, they do talk, but if Yahweh is there present, he doesn't speak through them. So there's not going to be a command of an archangel with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christo means drugged, shall rise first. I guess those poor souls that, like Dod, David, that passed away a thousand years before him. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together. We. Now, sorry, Paul, you got it wrong. And we're not going to be caught up in the air with him.
We're meeting him.
He's not coming for us, yeah. He's taking with them in the clouds to meet the Lord. The Lord is not going to be in the clouds. Well, Satan may be in the clouds. But the Lord is not. You know, it's one of the things that's really interesting about this chapter in the 18th chapter of 1 Kings. All the Lord, Satan, had to do to prove the faith of Baalism, which was essentially Christianity, was to ignite some sticks on fire. Do you know that Baal was always depicted with a thunderbolt in his hand? I mean, his shtick was fire. And all he had to do, he couldn't do it. Now, what does that tell you about the capacity of Satan? You know, he may have, 4 billion people on the planet, 5 billion people worshiping him. But he's not omnipresent.
He has no real power.
He's not omnipotent. He has no real power. And he can only be at one place at a time. He is given vastly more credit than he deserves. He is a lightning god, and he couldn't mean, even the Iowa says he's the prince of the air, right? He's a storm god.
Mm-hmm.
A storm god, he can't light a fire.
He's a good Boy Scout.
Yeah, your average Boy Scout could light a fire, but I have to stop calling Boy Scouts because they've just agreed to let girls into the Boy Scouts.
Oh, okay.
You're going to meet the Lord in the clouds, to meet the Lord in the air, and always be with the Lord. By the way, he's identifying the Lord, who is Satan, with Iusu, Christus. I'm a personally convinced, and I know this might yank some people's chains the wrong way. I don't think Yahusha existed prior to the time that Yahweh required a set apart, diminished, corporeal manifestation of his nature. And I don't think there's any reason for Yahusha as a diminished, set apart, corporeal manifestation of Yahweh's nature to exist after the end of the millennial Shabbat, after 7,000 Yah. I can't think of any reason whatsoever. And you can't have a material manifestation in 7D. Matter doesn't. There is no matter in any dimension greater than the four that we live in. It isn't possible. And so since Yahusha is a diminished corporeal manifestation of Yahweh set apart from him, I don't think he exists. Why would Yahweh need him?
Mm-hmm.
He's just part of Yahweh. He's the mouth of Yahweh. He's the sacrificial lamb of Yahweh. But personally, I don't think that there's any merit to him existing. Anyway, Paul says, therefore, comfort one another with these words.
Are you comforted? No.
I'm staggered that so many people are beguiled by Paul. He is so obviously a liar. So obviously contradicting Yahweh. So obviously full of himself. Admittedly demon-possessed. That my skin crawls to think that 3 billion people bow their knee to Paul. Now, it's interesting to note that Thomas Jefferson, perhaps the most brilliant American, saw through Paul's contradictions. From Monticello, on the 13th of April, 1820, he wrote the following in a letter to William Short. William Short is no average individual, but a huge percentage of Jefferson's correspondence is written to William Short. William Short is the man that Thomas Jefferson viewed as his adopted son. He was his closest friend, his closest confidant. So this is what he wrote. My granddaughter, Ellen, has undertaken to copy the syllabus. Now, the syllabus is a collection of Yahusha's words with all the Pauls removed, which will therefore be enclosed. It was originally written to Dr. Rush on his death, fearing that the inquisition of the public might get hold of it. I asked for the return of it from the family, which they kindly complied with. Isn't that amazing? That that he has a book that is a collection of Yosha's words, removing all the Pauls, and he wrote it for a friend, and yet he asked for it back, thinking if the public got it, there'd be an inquisition. Wow. Mm-hmm. At the request of another friend.
People weren't too happy.
Oh, no. I mean, people don't want their religion proven.
Kill my God.
Well, okay. It's okay for them to kill their God, for their God to die, but they don't want you
That's
to
right.
kill their
That's
God.
Right. Don't you do it. Don't you mess
yeah.
with it.
At the request of another friend, I had given him a copy. He lent it to his friend to read, who copied it. And in a few months, it appeared in a theological magazine of London, happily. That repository is scarcely known in this country. And the syllabus, therefore, is still a secret. And in your hands, I'm sure that it will continue to be. Now, here is the third President of the United States, first Vice President of the United States, the author of the Declaration of Independence. And he is begging a friend to keep this
Don't show this to anyone.
Collection of Yosha's words a secret. But while this syllabus is meant to place the character of Jesus, it's his mistake, and one he could have corrected. And he was very close to the time that the J was first invented, you know, about 75 years after it was first invented. And he was a linguist. He knew that it had been invented for the express purpose of improving Latin so that Latin would have a hard sound on what they thought were wimpy-sounding names that began with a vowel, the vowel I. I'm sure that he was aware of it. So he would have known there was no Jesus. And he would have known that the J was a most recent invention, and the Seuss was to fit Greek grammar rules. He wasn't Greek. So his mistake, and one he could have corrected. In its true and high light, as no imposter himself, but a great reformer of the Hebrew code of religion. I'm sorry, Tom. He understood that there was a code of conduct written in the Torah, and that Yosha was openly critical of religion, but unfortunately, he didn't think this through correctly. So, and he wasn't right in that regard. He did not try to reform the Hebrew code of religion. He was opposed to the Hebrew religion, the Jewish religion, and what he represented was the Torah in its pure form, unrevised. It is not to be understood that I am with him in all of his doctrines. In other words, Thomas Jefferson... He says, I am a materialist. Today we would call them a socialist secular humanist. I am a secular humanist materialist. And he takes the side of spiritualism. He preaches of the efficacy of repentance towards forgiveness. No, he actually doesn't. I require a counterpoise of good works to redeem it, etc., etc. It is the innocence of his character, the purity and sublimity of his moral precepts, the eloquence of his inculcations, and the beauty of his epilogues, in which he, and the way that he conveys them, that I so much admire. Sometimes, indeed, needing indulgence to Eastern hyperbolism. My eulogies, too, may be founded on a postulate, which all may not be ready to grant. Among the sayings and discourses imputed to him by his biographers, I find many passages of fine imagination, correct morality, and the most lovely benevolence, and others, again, of so much ignorance, so much absurdity, so much untruth and charlatanism and imposture as to pronounce it impossible that such contradictions could have proceeded from the same being. I separate, therefore, the gold from the dross, restore to him the former, and leave the latter up to the stupidity of some and roguery of others of his disciples. Of this band of dupes and impostors, Paul was the great Corypheus, the first corrupter of the doctrines of Jesus. These palatable interpolations and falsifications of his doctrine led me to try to sift them apart. I found the work obvious and easy, and that his part composed the most beautiful morsel of morality which has ever been given to us by man. The syllabus is, therefore, of his doctrines, not all of mine. I read them as I do those of other ancient and modern moralists with a mixture of appropriation and dissent. End quote. In Athenian drama, Corypheus was the leader of the chorus. His name was invoked to describe the leader of a cause or movement. Cicero called Zeno the Corypheus of the Stoics. Eustace of Antioch was called the great Corypheus of the Council of Nicaea. The reasons are interesting. Eustace was the principal opponent of Arians, who realized that Diotia was begotten and thus not a unique persona or separate god. On behalf of the Emperor Constantine in 325 CE, Eustathius led a parade to create a new god for the religion of Roman Catholicism. Similarly, Jefferson was in accord with Yahweh's statement in Yeshaya 6 with his Corypheus comparison. Remember I just said the leader of a boisterous religious band is what Yahweh said?
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson. Yeah. Used the same reference in referring to Corypheus. I wonder what Thomas Jefferson would have written, however, had he been given access to the Hebrew text of the Torah Nambi Wa Mizmor that we have been afforded. Lacking access to the Hebrew text, Yahweh's witness, there are numerous errors and nomenclature throughout the citations which follow. But I wanted to share them because their conclusions are universally valid. I was not the first to recognize that Paul's letters were contradictory to Yahusha's teaching. Now, as I read these, I want you to recognize that I'm not reading these because they affirm the conclusions that I have made. My conclusions on Paul have very little to do with his contradictions of Yahusha. Almost never quotes Yahusha. In fact, the only time he quoted him, he misquoted him. My issue with Paul is that his statements are universally contrary to Yahweh's in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. There isn't a single one of these that we're going to share that exposes and condemns Paul because he contradicted God, only because his words are incongruent with the person they erroneously called Jesus. All right, now here they are. Speaking of Jefferson's syllabus, the noted cosmologist Carl Sagan, he's a really interesting character you're going to hear from, wrote the following in his letter to Ken Shai, the author of Christianity Betrayed. My longtime view about Christianity is that it represents an amalgam of two seemingly immiscible parts, the religion of Jesus and the religion of Paul. Thomas Jefferson attempted to exorcise the Pauline parts of the New Testament, but there wasn't much left when he was done. But it was an inspiring document. Okay, there's no religion.
I've always been a big fan of Carl Sagan.
But Carl Sagan died.
You were thinking of things really helped shape who I am, because got real big into Carl Sagan in my early teens. So part of the reason I'm where I am now is because of Sagan.
Yeah,
so I love reading that one.
I would have loved to have had the opportunity to tell Carl Sagan, you know, there is no Jesus, there's a Yosha, and he does not have a religion. But everything else you wrote, spot on, man. You're right. My favorite historian, by far and away my favorite historian, is Will Durant. I don't know how many of you know of Durant. You probably have his collection. Kirk, you're into that sort of thing, do you?
No, I don't have his collection, but I know who he is, yes. I read
okay, well, he's the really large books called The History of Civilization. I think there's like 20 in the series, and he goes all the way from the dawn of man all the way through European history. Called The History of Civilization, it's just a marvelous. He and his wife, Will and Ariel Durant. So anyway, he is my favorite historian. In his volume Caesar and Christ, he wrote, "Paul created a theology which none but the vaguest warrants can be found in the words of Christ." Vaguest warrants. Wow. Through these interpretations, Paul could neglect the actual life and sayings of Jesus, which he had not directly known. Paul replaced conduct with creed as the test of virtue. It was a tragic change. Jesus got lost in the metaphysical fog of Paul's brain. Fundamentalism is the triumph of Paul of Tarsus over Jesus of Nazareth. That's pretty astute, too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We've all heard of George Bernard Shaw. He was the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1925. Well, in his Androcles and the Lion, said, "There is not one word of Pauline Christianity and the characteristic utterances of Jesus." Read that again. "There is not one word of Pauline Christianity and the characteristic utterances of Jesus." There has really never been a more monstrous imposition perpetrated than the imposition of Paul's soul upon the soul of Jesus. It is now easy to understand how Jesus was suppressed by the police and the church while Paulinism overran the whole of Western civilized world, which was at the time the Roman Empire, and was adopted as its official faith. No sooner had Jesus knocked over the dragon of superstition than Paul boldly set it back on its legs again in the name of Jesus. George Bernard Shaw. The Episcopal scholar and cleric, Bishop John Spong, wrote in Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism, "Paul's words are not the words of God. They are the words of Paul." A vast difference. I would change that very subtly. I don't have a problem with what he wrote, but I would just change this very subtly. Paul's words contradict the words of God.
Yeah.
Paul's words are Paul's words, not God's words. You ever heard of a fellow named Mahatma Gandhi?
Yes, indeed.
He's a fellow that
I'm not a big fan, but...
Yeah, you know, interesting fellow in that, I think there's all sorts of issues with Mahatma Gandhi. To his credit, his revolution was nonviolent. There's not a lot of those.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mahatma Gandhi won Indians from England through a nonviolent protest. In his discussion of fellowship, he wrote, "I draw a great distinction between the Sermon on the Mount of Jesus and the letters of Paul." Me too. Paul's letters are a graft on Christ's teachings. Paul's own gloss apart from Christ's own experience. Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist. Now, I'm not a big fan of Carl Jung. But it's just interesting to get these are world-renowned people, and here's their point of view. "A psychological approach to the dogma of the Trinity," he claimed. Saul's fanatical resistance to Christ was never entirely overcome. It is frankly disappointing to see how Paul hardly ever allows the real Jesus of Nazareth to get a word in.
So
he allowed him about five words, and he misquoted it.
Well, and he put words into his mouth a lot, too.
Yeah, well, it was still Paul's words. In Christ or Paul, the Reverend B.A. Holmes Gore opined, let the reader contrast the true Christian standard with that of Paul, and he will see the terrible betrayal of all that the Master taught. For the surest way to betray a great teacher is to misrepresent his message. That is what Paul and his followers did. And because the church has followed Paul in his error, it has failed, lamentably, to redeem the world. The teachings given by the blessed Master Christ, he's not a master and he's not Christ, with which the disciples, John and Peter and James, the brother of the Master, no, he's not the Master, tried in vain to defend and preserve intact, were utterly opposed to the Pauline gospel. As the light is opposed to the darkness. The theologian Soren Kierkegaard in the journals offered, in the teachings of Christ, Jesus is the prototype, and our task is to imitate him, become a disciple, actually. In the teachings, Dode is the prototype, and we're encouraged to imitate him. But then, through Paul, came a basic alteration. Paul draws attention away from imitating Christ and fixes attention on the death of Christ, the Atoner. What Martin Luther and his Reformation failed to realize is that even before Catholicism, Christianity had become degenerate at the hands of Paul. Paul made Christianity the religion of Paul, not of Christ. Paul threw the Christianity of Christ away, completely turning it upside down and making it the opposite of the original proclamation of Christ. Again, his choice of words is not ideal, but his conclusions are correct.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I've told that to Christians before. You know, the problem with the Reformation was it didn't go far enough. It got rid of a lot of the crap that the Roman Catholic Church had added, but it didn't go nearly far enough. It needed to go all the way back.
Yeah, all of these folks, unfortunately, think that Christ created Christianity, and what they're doing is just they're differentiating Paul, who's the opposite, said the opposite of what the person that they know as Jesus Christ has said and did. Ernst Renan wrote in his book, Saint Paul, true Christianity, which will last forever, comes from the gospel words of Christ, not from the epistles of Paul. The writings of Paul have been a danger and a hidden rock, the causes of the principal defects of Christian theology. Robert Frost, who was a four-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry and A Message of Mercy, recognized, Paul, he's first in the Bible too. He is the fellow who theologized Christ almost out of Christianity. Out for him. James Baldwin, an acclaimed African-American author, in his book The Fire Next Time offered, the real architect of the Christian church was not the disreputable, sun-baked Hebrew who gave it its name, but rather the mercilessly fanatical and self-righteous Paul. Martin Buber, the acclaimed philosopher in Two Types of Faith, correctly realized the Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount is completely opposed to Paul. In fact, what's called the Sermon on the Mount exposes and condemns Paul. The poet and author Khalil Gibran in Jesus, the Son of Man, published, by the way, you know, wasn't the Son of Man the preferred and most common epithet that Yosha used to describe himself?
Mm-hmm. I believe so.
Son of Man.
Could he have been the Son of Man if he was virgin born?
No.
No.
The reason that Yeshua doesn't speak of a virgin birth. But you know who has a virgin birth? The Lord. That's a virgin birth in the and the
Nimrod story
dominates the Canaanite scriptures. By the way, you know what language the Canaanite scriptures are written in?
Probably in Hebrew type. Syriac? I don't
know. They're in Hebrew.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. In fact, they used the Hebrew alphabet, the Hebrew grammar. What they did, though, is they used cuneiform in clay to replicate the Hebrew letters, creating the same sound, same order, same words, same grammar, but it's all Hebrew. It's the oldest text, the oldest, earliest text that scholars could read, because they figured out right away it was written in Hebrew. Theologian Helmut Koester, in the Theological Aspects of Primitive Christian Heresy, claims, Paul himself stands in the twilight zone of heresy. In reading Paul, one immediately encounters a major difficulty. Whatever Jesus had preached did not become the content of the missionary proclamation of Paul. Sayings of Jesus do not play a role in Paul's understanding of the events of salvation. Paul did not care at all what Jesus said. Had Paul been completely successful, very little of the sayings of Jesus would have survived. It's also true. I still want to know, why do 3 billion people on the planet today believe this man was inspired to speak for God and that his words are scripture?
It has to be related to, Yahusha was Torah observant, then the only thing he offered was that which they should have already known, because he quoted strictly out of the Torah.
Right.
Everything goes back to the Torah. Everything he talked to,
right,
go back to the
right.
Torah,
right.
Go back to the Torah.
Right.
So he didn't create any new religion, so they don't have
right.
one.
Right.
So
the Torah is an anti-religion.
Because it owes him of him, because otherwise they have no new religion.
Right. Yeah, you can't create a religion. End quote, Yosha. English philosopher Jeremy Bentham, and not Paul, but Jesus, posed this question. It rests with every professor of the religion of Jesus to settle within himself to which of the two religions, that of Jesus or that of Paul, will he adhere? Unknown to Bentham, Yosha was overtly opposed to religion while Paul founded a religion, further exacerbating the conflict between them. Jewish scholar Haim McElby, in his book The Mythmaker, calls Paul the ultimate mythmaker because much of what Paul wrote doesn't stand up to close and careful scrutiny. Indeed, as we have seen, the purpose of the book of Acts is to minimize the conflict between Paul and the leaders of the Jerusalem church, James and Peter. Peter and Paul, in later Christian tradition, became twin saints, founders in the faith, and the idea that they were historically bitter opponents standing for irreconcilable religious standpoints would have been repudiated with honor. The work of the author of Acts was well done. He rescued Christianity from the imputation of being the individual creation of Paul, and instead gave it a respectable pedigree as a doctrine with the authority of the so-called Jerusalem Church, conceived as a continuous in spirit with the Pauline Gentile Church of Rome. Yet for all of his efforts, the truth of the matter is not hard to recover. If we examine the New Testament evidence with an eye to the telltale inconsistencies and confusions, rather than to the determination to gloss over all and harmonize all the difficulties and interests of Orthodox interpretation, it's not hard. It's easy. All you have to do is have an open mind. And that's true. That's the most dangerous book, actually, in the Christian New Testament isn't Paul's book to the Romans or to the Corinthians or to the Thessalonians or his first to the Galatians. It is what Luke did for him. It's creating some credible pedigree by starting with Peter, with one of Yosha's disciples and the fulfillment of Shavua. said, from there he tries to graft in the Pauline, make this transition to Paul as if there was a handoff of the baton, and it's all Paul thereafter. Makes it the most dangerous book. By the way, that last quote was from a Talmudic scholar. Pretty good for him. Mm-hmm. Historian and fellow theologian Ferdinand Christian Barr in Church History of the First Three Centuries questioned, what kind of authority can there be for an apostle who, unlike the other apostles, had never been prepared for the apostolic office in Jesus' own school, but had only later dared to claim the apostolic office on the basis of his own authority? The only question comes to be how the Apostle Paul appears in his epistles to be so indifferent to the historical facts of the life of Jesus. He bears himself but little like a disciple who has received the doctrines of the principles which he preaches from the master whose name he bears. Albert Schweitzer, the renowned physician and missionary, the winner of the 1952 Nobel Prize, in The Quest for the Historical Jesus, a critical study in the progress of Remarus to Wheaty, concluded correctly regarding the letter of the leader here of the Christian parade. He wrote, Paul did not desire to know Christ. Paul shows us that with complete indifference to the earthly life of Jesus was regarded. What is the significance for our faith? The fact that the gospel of Paul is different from the gospel of Jesus. The attitude which Paul himself takes up to and towards the gospel of Jesus is that he does not repeat it in the words of Jesus. He does not appeal to its authority. The fateful thing is that the Greek, the Catholic, and the Protestant theologies all contain the gospel of Paul in a form which does not continue the gospel of Jesus, but displaces it. Of course, Jesus didn't have a gospel, but he understood that that Paul's letters simply replace
the authority, you know.
What Yosha did and said. Shortly thereafter, Switzer would write in The Mysticism of Paul and the Apostle that Paul's mysticism was a union with the divinity brought about by efficacious ceremonies which were found even in quite primitive religions. Indeed. Paul did what every pagan religion has done before him. It was an amalgamation of lies. That's why religion is referred to as Babel, that commixing of lies together. He compared Pauline mysticism to the Greek mystery cults of the first century CE, including those attributed to Osiris and Mithras. He concluded, where possible, Paul avoids quoting the teachings of Jesus, in fact, even mentioning it. If we had to rely on Paul, we would not know what Jesus taught in parables, that he had delivered the Sermon on the Mount, and had taught his disciples about the Father. Even where they are especially relevant, Paul passes over the words of Jesus. Just prior to setting off for Africa, Switzer became convinced that the search for the historical Jesus was futile. He just didn't have access to the tools we have today. The Jesus of Nazareth, who came forward publicly as the Messiah, who preached the ethic of the kingdom of God, who founded the kingdom of heaven upon the earth and died to give us his work, his final consecration never existed. He is a figure designed by rationalism, endowed with life by liberalism, and clothed by modern theology in a historical garb. This image has not been destroyed from outside. It has fallen into pieces. Yeah, the Christian Jesus bears absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to the life of Yosha. Well, it has nothing to do with Paul. Switzer's views on colonialism are worth considering. He said this before heading off to Africa. Who can describe the injustice and cruelties that in the course of centuries the colored peoples have suffered at the hands of Europeans? If a record could be compiled, by the way, you could just take Americans, what they did to the Native Americans, the Indians. If a record could be compiled of all that has happened between the white and the colored races, it would make a book containing numbers of pages which the reader would have to turn over unread because their contents would be too horrible. Then in a sermon he preached on January 6, 1905, he said, "Our culture divides people into two classes, civilized men, a title bestowed on persons who do the classifying, and others, who have only the human form, who may perish or go to the dogs for all the civilized men care. Oh, this noble culture of ours, it speaks so piously of human dignity and human rights, and then denigrates this dignity and those rights of countless of millions and treads them underfoot, only because they live overseas or because their skins are a different color or because they cannot help themselves. This culture does not know how hollow and miserable and full of glib talk it is, how common it looks to those who follow it across the seas and see what it has done there. And this culture has no right to speak of personal dignity and human rights. I will not enumerate the crimes that have been committed under the pretext of justice. People rob native inhabitants of their land, made slaves of them, let loose the scum of mankind upon them. Think of the atrocities that were perpetrated upon people, made subservient to us, how systematically we have ruined them with our alcoholic gifts and everything else we have done. We decimated them. And by the yoke of a pen, we take their land. So they have nothing left at all." It sounds like he's writing about the American conquest of the lands of the American Indians, doesn't it?
Well, that
all of this, yeah, boy, you better rally around the flag, love your country, or leave it.
He wouldn't salute the flag either.
No. If all of these, know what anybody who knows the truth.
Brain.
If all of this oppression and all of this sin and shame are perpetrated under the eye of the German God or the American God or the British God, and if our states do not feel obligated first to lay aside their claim to be Christian, and then in the name of Jesus is blasphemed and made a mockery, and the Christianity of our states is blasphemed and made a mockery before these poor people, the name of Jesus has become a curse. And our Christianity, yours and mine, has become a falsehood and a disgrace if the crimes are not atoned for in the very place where they have been instigated. For every person who committed an atrocity in Jesus' name, someone must step in and help in Jesus' name. For every person who has robbed someone, must find a replacement. For everyone who is cursed, someone must bless. So now, when you speak about missions, let this be your message. We must make atonement for all the terrible crimes we have read in the newspapers. We must make atonement for the still worse ones, which we do not read in the papers, crimes that are shrouded in the silence of the jungle night. Wow. Huh?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, we are. It's neo-Nazis and white supremacy. Yeah, go to hell.
Yeah.
The aforementioned 17th century German theologian and professor William Reed argued that without Paul, Christianity would have become just another backwater Jewish sect that would have had little influence in later religious development. He concluded, Paul was the second, actually only, founder of Christianity. He noted that Paul was definitely influenced by certain Hellenistic concepts. The concept is called Gnosticism. And as a result, his understanding of the flesh-spirit dualism parallels that of many others who profess that matter itself was inherently corrupted. That was the whole concept. That was Plato, Aristotle, Socrates. That's their whole shtick. Gnosticism, that matter is inherently corrupted. It's an inferior version of that which exists in the spiritual world. They were wrong. Paul copied them, plagiarized them. In his book, simply named Paulos, Weed wrote, "The obvious contradictions in the three accounts given by Paul with regard to his conversion are enough to arouse distrust. The moral majority of Jesus, the moral majesty of Jesus, his purity and piety, his ministry among his people, his manner as a prophet, and his whole concrete ethical religious content of his earthly life signifies for Paul's Christology nothing whatsoever. The name disciple of Jesus has little that is applicable to Paul, Jesus or Paul. This alternative characterizes, at least in part, the religious and theological warfare of the present day. More recently, Marcello Craveri and his Life of Jesus, which he claimed was based upon the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay.
No.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Which he claimed was based, argued that the emphasis on the redeeming power of Christ's death on the cross would be seen as reworkings by Paul, who was probably influenced strongly by Greco-Roman traditions. I'll guarantee you one thing. There's no mention of a cross or the death of God or of a Christ.
Of a Christ.
In the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the Dead Sea Scrolls. Rudolf Bultmann, yet another theologian, in Significance of the Historical Jesus for the Theology of Paul, published, "It is most obvious that Paul does not appeal to the words of the Lord in support of his views. When the essentially Pauline conceptions are considered, it is clear that Paul is not dependent on Jesus. Jesus' teaching is, to all intents and purposes, irrelevant for Paul."
That's true.
That's true. Walter Bauer, another noted scholar in Orthodoxy and Heresy in the Earliest Christianity, wrote, "If one may be allowed to speak rather pointedly, the Apostle Paul was the only arch-heretic known to the apostolic age." The English professor Jeremy Bentham in Not Paul But Jesus surmised that if Christianity needed an antichrist, they needed look no further than Paul. In the introduction to section 7, he published, "The two persons in question, as represented in the two sources of information, Jesus and Paul's epistles, two different, if not opposite, religions are incalculated. In Jesus may be found all the good that has ever been, but in the religion of Paul, all the mischief, which in such disastrous abundance has so indisputably flown from it." Yeah. If you want to know what the Torahless one that will be known to Christians as the Antichrist will be like, what he will say, what he will claim, how he will act, look at Paul.
Look at Paul.
Read Paul's letters.
Yeah.
Paul is the Antichrist. Paul is the Torahless one. Now, is he the one that is going to come in the last 7 years, beginning in fall of 2026?
Nope.
Yes and no.
Well,
yes and no. The demon that possessed Paul. Absolutely,
yes,
the same demon.
Yeah.
The demon that Paul admitted possessed him in the end of the second letter of Corinthians. The demon that he acknowledged possessed him is going to be the exact same demon that's going to possess the Torahless one known to Christians as Antichrist. So the personality, the style, the motivations, the testimony, exactly the same. Now, I do think that, in fact, I'm certain of it, that the same demon that possessed Paul possessed Muhammad.
Yeah.
And so we'll see a little Muhammad mixed into the Torahless one known as the Antichrist as well. And if you want to know about him, read Prophet of Doom. It's free at prophetofdoom.net. But there's no question at all that Paul is the Torahless one. Paul is the Antichrist. He will be indistinguishable. H.L. Mencken, whom some consider among the most influential American writers in the first half of the 20th century, wrote in Notes on Democracy, "It is argued by any rational man that the debased Christianity cherished by the mob in all the Christian countries of today has any colorable likeness to the body of ideas preached by Christ. The plain fact is that this bogus Christianity has no more relation to the system of Christ than it has to Aristotle. It is the invention of Paul and his attendant rabble-rousers, a body of men exactly comparable to the core of evangelical pastors today, which is to say a body devoid of sense and lamentably indifferent to honesty.
Wow.
The mob, having heard Christ, turned against him. The theological ideas are too logical and plausible for it, and his ethical ideas were enormously too austere. What it yearned for was the old, comfortable balderdash under a new, gaudy name. And that is precisely what Paul offered it. He borrowed from all the wandering dervishes and body snatchers of Asia Minor and flavored the stew with remnants of Greek demonology. The result was a code of doctrine so discordant and so nonsensical that no two men since, examining it at length, have ever agreed upon its precise meaning. Paul remains to the arch-theologian, remains the arch-theologian of the mob. His turgent and witless metaphysics make Christianity bearable to men who would otherwise be repelled by Christ's simple and magnificent reduction of the duties of men. Cool.
That's actually very telling. People wonder why there are so many different denominations in Christianity, and largely it is all of them trying to coincide, try and make Paul fit Yahusha. They can't do it. They all argue over how to do it, and some want to give Paul credit in one area and Yahusha in the other, and no, we need to look at this. You take him out, it all makes sense.
I recall so many passages and in questioning Paul from the book of Galatians, where I would write the passage as it's presented in the Nestle Allen interlinear that accompanies the Nestle Allen. Then I would provide a literal translation of what Paul said. And if you remove the copyists who have tried to buff up Paul so that he sounds almost sane,
intelligible.
Yeah, and you just said, this is what he wrote. It's just jumble. It's verbal diarrhea. It's like much of the Quran. It's verbal diarrhea. Just.
That's why I know likely it is the same, isn't it?
Yeah, and even when he waxes, poetic, like he does in his love chapter of Corinthians, almost everything he said is untrue.
It's ridiculous. Beyond untrue, it's
just
ridiculous.
Yes, of course it's ridiculous. It not only contradicts God, it is absolutely untrue. All you have to do is think. That's what he says. It's balderdash. They're rabble-rousers. Bunch of body snatchers. Devoid of sense. You get the point.
And all this brilliance that you just read, all these brilliant men and perhaps some women in there, I forget. Why did they not take the leap to examine what he was saying against the Torah?
I think the reason for that is that mankind has universally rejected the Torah. And I mean that Rabbinic Judaism is built on the Talmud.
They do too, yeah.
Yeah, they do too. Christians absolutely do. And for good reason, the Torah is absolutely the death knell of their religion. And so
they want power, and it doesn't give them power.
No,
I don't think there's one person in a million who appreciates the Torah. Only one person in a million. So none of these people were educated in the Torah. But
they carried around with them the same source that they would have picked up the Christian New Testament was right there. Surely that should have disturbed some of them, you would think.
Yeah, and all you really have to do, if you read the first book of what's called the Christian New Testament.
Yeah, the Matthew.
Just read Matthew.
Mm-hmm. Matthew,
Matthew is the antithesis of Paul's 13 letters. They're absolutely opposites. Opposites cannot both be true. That's all you have to do. Now, the fact is, that everything Yosha said was quoting Yahweh.
Yeah.
And so if you actually read what Yahweh had to say about him, holy mackerel.
Yeah.
Yeah. God, there is no person in the history of humankind rises more than Shaul. He has more to say about him than any other foe. Now, he does say more about Dod and Shamuel and others of his prophets than he says of Paul. But for foes, Paul gets more ink by probably 100-fold than the next greatest villain. So, folks, you either have to be ignorant.
The only one, the one that would come close would be Baal.
Yeah, but Baal's not a person.
The same spirit, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Baal's Satan.
Yeah.
The Lord is Satan. When Christians, and this is the point of that debate that between Elijah, and the 850 prophets of Baal, is that Baal is Satan. To bow the knee to Baal is an eternal sentence in Sheol. If you are promoting Baal, if you're bowing your knee in submission to Baal, you don't get the reprieve of just simply dying. The Lord is Satan. If you're submitting to him, you'll get to spend your eternity with him. That's the message of the 18th chapter of 1 Kings. Yeah, it's really powerful. Well, anyway, I wanted people to have the opportunity to recognize how many people, I'm sure that's just a fraction of them, have written about Paul. You either have to be ignorant or irrational to believe Paul. And that's why religion is synonymous with faith, not reason.
Well, what I find interesting is just, you know, how well known these people are, yet nobody knows that they ever said this about Paul. That it's been, I don't want to say covered up, but it's, yeah, they were not very vocal about these findings. Yeah, it tells you a lot about society.
Right, we have revised
people like this feel,
everyone.
You know, right. Don't feel comfortable coming out and saying this in public.
We are, right, as Americans, afraid to talk about George Washington in the context of the most important thing in his life, Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
We're afraid to talk about Abraham Lincoln as he presented himself in the Lincoln-Douglas debates as being a racist so vile that he wanted concentration camps for black people, Negroes as he called them, because they were unfit to live with whites.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he didn't want another slave state. He wanted them all in turn concentration camps. We don't want to talk about the fact that Jefferson not only was a deist and a humanist, but that he condemned Paul. We don't want to talk about the fact that that Jefferson warned about the two greatest ills in America, a central bank and an established military.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't want to talk about the fact that Yosha, not Jesus, was Torah observant, as opposed to having created a religion. And we have revisionist history. We've dumbed ourselves down by presenting caricatures of historical individuals. That's why so many people are so stupid. And by the way, that is the gist of 1 Kings 18, that people are just flat out stupid. And you can't fix stupid.
This
I'd like
week,
to turn to... Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say this week, in preparation for the next observation, I went back to two books that I have on the shelf that are Christian apologists, and they're a compilation of tons and tons and tons of material. And if you allow me to share it with you next time on observation,
sure.
It is the counter to what we're doing, as that's why I went back to them. It is so feeble. It is so feeble. It just, they got nothing. I mean,
yeah.
These
and
are
by
these
the way,
are
one of the things we're talking about it being feeble and mocking them, that's one of
mm-hmm.
the things that is just so remarkable about the Elia debate. He just flat out mocks them.
Yeah.
And at the end, he says, I'm speaking the word of God exactly in accordance with the way Yahweh told me to say these things. And he is laughing at them, mocking. He, at one point, he says, maybe your God's not answering you because he's out taking a dump.
Oh,
I love it.
Why did you not? He says, you know, one place he says, they must be asleep. You need to talk a little louder. Maybe you'll wake him up. Oh, it's hilarious. I love it, too. All right, so the Yashaya 520 reads, well, this is a warning. Oi! This disastrous and destructive situation can ruin a person. So this is the cautionary tale. To the one among those who call that which is evil good, and that which is good evil, who replaces darkness for light, and light for darkness, who replaces that which is bitter and anguishing for that which is sweet and pleasant, and that which is makes one pleasing for poison, which embitters. What is the purpose of the Christian New Testament? To replace the Old Testament.
To replace this.
What's the purpose of Jesus? To replace the old God.
Mm-hmm.
That's the purpose.
Yeah.
Well, this is a warning. To those who call that which is evil good. Paul, what he wrote was pure evil. Christians call it good. And you call that which is good evil. Torah is good. They call it evil. To replace darkness for light. Whew. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, this is...
I was just going to say, replaces the Moab Mikra. You can't test
right.
The path. How are you going to... If you're going to be a follower away and go down the path, how are you going, what path are you going to go down if you replace, if you disregard all those? You have nothing.
Correct.
You can't get
home. Right.
That's right.
You cannot get home. That which is evil, la ha ra, that which is wrong, contemptible, malicious, noxious, worthless, miserable, and injurious with good, that which is correct, beneficial, generous, beautiful, enjoyable, and pleasing, who replaces darkness, ignorance, confusion, the condition in which evil thrives and death prevails, for light, energy and enlightenment, the essence of time, the source of guidance, and light for darkness, and replaces that which is bitter, that which is sweet. Oh, yes, I mean, that's the whole Christian concept. That Old Testament, that's bitter stuff. You can't deal with that. It's just arcane.
Oh, mean God.
Mean-spirited and wrathful, bitter God. That God's in a bitter barn. What we have is the new and improved God. He loves everyone. He just wants to save everybody. He wants to bless everyone. Oh, we're all little children who can come to Him. And God is saying, when you do that, woe to you. That's the very definition of Babel, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Of the Christian Bible's propensity to intermix truth and lies, good and bad, light and darkness. That which nourishes, that which poisons. The purpose, of course, is to confuse by corrupting God's message, inverting His witness. Of this, Paul was a maestro. God goes on to say, woe, this is a warning. To the learned and scholarly, the crafty and cunning in their own eyes, and to those making connections as a contrarian through their appearance and public persona. You know, ignorance is deadly. There is something far more contemptible. Those who mislead under false pretenses are vastly more dangerous and deplorable. That's what God thinks.
Mm-hmm.
The warning to those who are teachers, who are professors, who are media spokespeople, who are politicians, who are generals, who are pastors, the learned and scholarly, the crafty and cunning in their own eyes, in their own sight, and those making connections as a contrarian through their appearance and public persona.
This was the verse he sent me to the books. You know, just the verse. Well, yeah. I said, well, let's see what they got to say, and by gosh.
God is not overly concerned about the victims of these lies. He wishes they weren't victimized, but he doesn't know them. He just doesn't know them. The victimizers, those who get on their hall, you know, these megachurch pastors, these tele-evangelists, these politicians, that blog writers now that get on their high horse and pretend to know, these guys that do these videos for promoting conspiracy theories, it's a warning to them. What they're doing has consequences, and they will be held accountable. Whoa, this is a warning to the powerful and influential, to politicians and military heroes, to Gibor, the strong and mighty, the valiant soldiers and warriors, the most prominent individuals in positions of leadership within a society, to those who fight for power and prevail. As a result of becoming drunk by consuming wine, and to individuals of nobility and wealth with regard to mingling and mixing together intoxicants which impair judgment, who justify and acquit those who are wicked and evil as a quid pro quo to gain influence, thereby turning away those who are upright and righteous, correct and vindicated from him. It is the leaders that God is going to hold accountable. It's a warning to the powerful and influential. That's what Sheol was created for. They are drunk on their own intoxicants. And they are mixing drugs together. They're mixing prescription drugs with illicit drugs and with alcohol and all manner of things. Yes, 90 million Americans, a third of all adults, have prescriptions for variations of OxyContin. That does not count those who are addicted to heroin or fentanyl, much less those who are intoxicated by crack cocaine or other forms of cocaine or any of the drugs of choice today, the recreational drugs or the alcohol. The number of Americans who are intoxicated is not 1 in 3 who are drugged and intoxicated. It's got to be very close to a significant majority. This is what we have done to ourselves. You know, we had an opportunity to witness the malfeasance. I think it was Henry Weisland, the fellow that was the movie producer, been on the front page of the news for about a week and a half for his abuse of women and threatening women that you either have sex with me or I'm going to ruin your career.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the majority of powerful people. People with influence and power in politics, in the military, in business, in the media, they act this way. He isn't unique in this regard. He's common. But God says, you know, you're drunk by consuming intoxicants. Same is true of the wealthy with regard to mingling and mixing things together. And so many people are accustomed to bribes. In fact, one of the world's largest corporations, Airbus, announced it 2 weeks ago. They said the investigation of the bribery allegations that Airbus is going to fundamentally change the company. It is so pervasive how many people are able to be bribed, how many people gain power as a revolt of bribery, how many people are willing to turn away and victimize people. I was reading an article about Donald Trump this morning, and what he did in the town that I lived in at the time. I witnessed him come in and buy a golf course in Rancho Palos Verdes, and the way that he sued everybody in sight and gloated, and I mean, he was despicable.
Mm-hmm.
This was about 30 years ago. He was absolutely despicable. And you saw the same man then that has become president, just bull in a china cabinet. You know, he'd walk into neighbors' homes that they were trying to mediate differences. He said, God, your house is ugly as shit. He had a dispute with a fellow over the school district owned a piece of land that his golf course the previous owners had leased, and he wanted to control it outright, and so he sued the Palos Verdes school district, and the attorney representing the California school district said, "Yeah, we're just not going to roll over for you." But, you know, Trump had more money, and after they had bled a few hundred thousand dollars, the school district decided they would settle with him, and Trump was able to buy the land from them, and Trump begins his press conference on the opening day of his development, and he gloats as to how he triumphed over the school district and said that the attorney representing him was an a-hole. That attorney, by the way, is on the Federal Sixth Court of Appeals right now is one of the attorneys that has repeatedly judges denounced Trump in some of his executive orders. But it's just, that's the nature of these people. And God is exposing them for who they are. So let's collectively review the Yeshaya from 5:18 through 5:23. This is what it says. Whoa, this is a warning regarding a disastrous and destructive situation which can ruin a person. So this is a cautionary tale to those who take the lead in promoting error by twisting and distorting in a boisterous and agonizing religious parade of error, futility, and vanity, of worthless lies, pagan gods, and idolatrous images, false and empty promises. As you read about the Canaanite religion, that's what he's talking about here, and it is Christianity today. As with the ties that bind on the harness of a cart of sin, the one among them says, without thinking and with anxiety over the future, he should want to hurry. I want him to swoop down and accelerate his work so that we may see it. So then let the counsel of the cross and painful advice of the Holy One of Israel approach and present itself, because we want to have it revealed and shown to us. That's a reference directly to Paul's letter to the Thessalonians. Whoa, this is a warning to those, to the ones among those who call that which is evil, that which is wrong, contemptible, malicious, noxious, and worthless, miserable and injurious, good, correct, beneficial, generous and enjoyable and pleasing, and that which is wrong, who replaces darkness, obscurity, and the cause of ignorance and confusion for light and enlightenment, the essence of time and source of guidance and the light for darkness, who replaces that which is bitter and anguishing, disagreeable and obstinate and rebellion and defiance for that which is sweet and pleasant, nourishing and acceptable, even enjoyable, and that which makes one pleasing and acceptable for poison, which embitters through a toxic mix of obstinate rebellion. Well, this is a warning to the learned and scholarly, the crafty and cunning, in their own eyes, and from the perspective, and their perspective, giving the impression and outward appearance of understanding, and to those making connections as the contrarian through their appearance and public persona. Whoa. This is a warning to the powerful and influential, to politicians and military heroes, as a result of becoming drunk by consuming wine, becoming inebriated, and to individuals of nobility and wealth with regard to intermingling and commixing together intoxicants which impair judgment, to justify and acquit those who are wicked and evil as a quid pro quo to gain influence, thereby turning away and rejecting those who are upright and righteous, shipwrecked and vindicated from him. What is the advantage to a man who accumulates a fortune on earth and who lords over many if he forfeits his soul in the process?
Well, worse than that, he winds up in Sheol. It's bad enough that he just dies and goes away. But
you want the express tickets to Sheol?
Yeah.
Bow before the Lord.
There you go.
Bow before the Lord. That is the express ticket to Sheol. Bow before the Lord.
Let me ask you and James a question.
Uh-huh.
The other day, or maybe it was yesterday, or maybe it was this morning, I thought it was yesterday, Terry was reading me some headlines about Trump talking about kind of the new standard in America is you're putting a great emphasis on the Judeo-Christian ideals. Would be like the... that's religion.
Of course,
we're not.
Yes,
when he says Judo, he's not talking about the Torah. He's talking about the your rabbinical Judaism, and he's not. When he talks about Christianity, he's talking about Paul. That's going to be the
correct
new standard. So, how long do we have to be on
there?
Oh
yeah, I mean, yeah, no, I know.
I mean, they're going to come for us
eventually.
I don't care. Of course.
Yeah.
Take your shot, pal.
Politics and religion against those who are not political and religious. And that's his deal.
Yeah.
You're going to be, he is pro-military, pro-patriotism.
Pro-war, man.
Pro-war, pro-religion, all of the things that God tells us to be wary of and to distance ourselves from. He says, if you're either agree with me and accept that, or the hell with you. You know, it's interesting, in the NFL disputes, even those who are taking a knee, and I agree with you, you know, why take a knee? Just sit down. I mean, that's what when the national anthem is played, I used to go to the bathroom in the stadium.
Yeah, go get a hot dog. We did that.
Well, I'll go get a hot dog. I'll just
rodeo,
anything,
we did the same thing.
Right. Anything. Yeah. Just leave the stadium. Although at one time I got up a little too late and at Baylor in Waco, Texas, and some Christian buffoons.
Good old boys.
You stand there in attention.
Yeah,
I looked at him and said, what are you going to do? Yeah, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Yeah, you want to assault and battery? Want to spend the next year in jail? Go ahead. Just bullets. Patriotic brats. But that is what is happening in the... in America, and I think to a large degree around the world, nationalism and patriotism and militarism, religion, they are all running amok. And religion in America, you know, is now this divide. Christianity is losing, of course, adherence at an amazing rate. But socialist secular humanism is growing at an amazing rate, and it's growing with a religious zeal. Yeah. Yeah, it's none of the protesters, every one of them says none of them claims to be anti-patriotic or against the flag
or anti-military. Yeah,
right. One of them.
They're
all make everything.
Oh no, we love the truth.
Oh yeah,
we
love
the military.
Truth.
Just don't like the police.
Yeah,
right?
We love our flag. We're patriotic. Good God. You know, what's wrong with you? Those are the problems. Now, the problem is the police. The problem is the military. The problem is patriotism.
What happened to the hippies?
I know. So it's so interesting reading whether they're now Antifa and are anarchists. But it's amazing that they're anarchists that are extraordinarily greedy because they want to confiscate what productive people have made, and they think that it belongs to them. It is interesting when I read that story about that president, that the one who in the Islamic country said, you know, Islam is responsible for its own problems. That Islam breeds terrorism. That as you know, he was reviewing the world. What he constantly said is America's got no clue as to why so many people dislike it around the world, and so much of it is these kinds of things where, you know, you perpetrate the crisis in the Ukraine by starting the revolt and arming the revolt, and then you blame the revolt on the people that were trying to resolve it. I mean, to blame, he said, you know, to blame Putin for the Ukraine is, when the United States started, is insane. He went on so far as to say, yeah, think for a moment of how stupid it is for America, how ironic it is for America, how hypocritical it is for America to say that the Russians interfered with their election by running ads on Facebook, when America has meddled in every election around the world for the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who in the world is the Americans think they are? Have no idea
than that. I could name
200. Yeah, a lot more serious ways. Right.
Yeah. Have you been watching the thing on PBS about Vietnam?
No. Boy. What did they say about Vietnam?
I wasn't going to, and then one night it was there, and I watched it. It'll make you sick about America.
What is the gist of it?
Well, the gist of it, at least the hour or so that I watched, yeah, they went through the McNamara thing where they decided. Of course, I've seen the tapes and everything before of what he says with LBJ, but they got together in 65, and McNamara says, you know, there's a big bunch of them in a room, and McNamara says, you know, there's no way we can win this war. We're never going to do anything. We keep killing our own people.
Right.
They'll take 10 deaths for every one that we have. And he said, you need to get out. And the other option was, he said, well, why don't we negotiate with Russia and put some force on these people to negotiate. And they all took a vote, and they all came out 10 out of 10, or so, well, 10 to 1. No, we're going to vote for more killing. Send more troops. And then they went in all the real-life stuff of them going in and burning. They go into a little village, and because they decided these little people are communists, they run them all out and shoot them all up. They kill children. They kill all the Vietnamese that don't bow down immediately. Then they burn their homes, and then they say, we're here to save you from the communists.
Yeah.
Beg your pardon?
Yeah. It's like, what did we do in Iraq and Afghanistan? We destroyed those countries. We bombed the living daylights out of them. And we said, by the way,
there's an orange everywhere. You can't live it. You can't grow anything.
That's right.
Where they bombed it.
Right.
And I was amazed of that they would literally they interviewed the
Americans
general
drugged out of their mind in Vietnam. I mean, I don't blame the troops for the majority of them being drugged, because how would you deal with it? And I can't even blame the volunteers now who were part of the work of America's war machine in Desert Storm and each of the subsequent invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, because what they were asked to do was insane.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're drugged out of them, 650,000 of them being drugged now as a result of claiming post-traumatic stress syndrome. So the stress was...
I can't remember who it was, but I saw an interview with someone who's a Iraq war veteran, and they were talking about the amount of people coming back with PTSD, and his response was, those are the ones with a conscience.
Yeah. It's been destroyed. What we've asked them to do is insane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're not heroes. We've turned them into mushmelons.
Yeah,
dangerous to themselves and dangerous to society. We've destroyed their lives. And you ought not honor that. You ought not pretend that they've provided for our freedoms, that they defended the country. America had absolutely nothing
at stake
in Afghanistan or Iraq. Nothing. Nothing.
No.
Or Libya. Or Syria. Nothing. All of the deaths, all of the money, didn't make America safer, didn't make America free. It's all a lie. Made a lot of people
healthier. At best, they deserve our pity.
Killed a lot of people. Changed the demographics of the world. It took us right to the doorstep of World War III, but it sure as hell didn't create any liberty or freedom or security for America did exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
Why can't we see that? Can't even talk about it today without being...
No, then you'd be anti-American, anti-patriotic, anti-everything.
Yeah.
Shut you down.
Yeah. You know, all they say is, well, what other country is better? Well, there are other better countries, but that's not the litmus test. You know, it's it's like Trump running against Hillary Clinton. Well, who's the better candidate?
The best of bad don't make it good.
Right. Correct. And, you know, in today's world, it's very hard for a country to be good because, in particular, the United States, like the Carthaginians, imposed its will. You know, we became so dominant militarily and, for a while, so dominant economically that we could impose our will on the rest of the world, and we did.
Yeah, if you can shut down the ports, they can't do anything.
Correct.
That's why we have a navy.
That's right. Yeah, you control the seas. You didn't play by American standards. One of the great examples of this just utter stupidity is that North Korea is essentially part of China.
Sure.
85% of its trade. Without China, North Korea ceases to exist as an independent country. You know, when we invaded North Korea during the Korean War, the Americans weren't killed by the North Koreans, they were killed by the Chinese.
Yeah, 300, hundreds of thousands of them at a time.
Right.
Yeah.
You want to resolve Korea, you can't be sailing warships through the South China Sea and besmirching the reputation of China. You can't be withholding sales of products to China and threatening China, as America is doing, or condemning China or blaming China for espionage that we're far more guilty of. If you want to deal with the Korean situation, the Korean situation can be resolved, but only by China. And China's not about to help the United States out in this regard. No.
Yeah.
That's a thorn in America's side that China just says, yeah, well, you treat us like crap.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Actually.
I'm not going to help you out. Why would I help you out? Right. And are you? There's just so many things like that in today's world. Here, Trump has decertified the Iran deal. The Iran deal was, which was a bad deal at the time, no question about it. But the Iran deal was agreed to by the Iranians because they had $75 billion in foreign reserves that were tied up, confiscated from them, and held from them. And they wanted that, and they wanted the ability to sell their oil around the world. That's what the Iran deal gave them. All they had to do was shut down the worst of their centrifuges and leave their uranium at 20% refined towards the uranium-235. And that was it. So how in the world are you going to renegotiate the deal when they already have
the money,
what they wanted? Yeah, they already have what they wanted. And if, let's say that you do renegotiate the deal and all you can impose on them is sanctions on them, what's that going to do? If you imposed, told Europe they can't buy oil from Iran anymore, well, then they have to buy it from Russia. But you've got sanctions on Russia. So what are they going to do? If you're going to put sanctions on Iran again, you strengthen the hand of China and Russia.
Yeah.
And you don't get there. You think that you're I'll give you the $75 billion back. And let's just start over again. When you've already given the other party what they wanted, how do you renegotiate? What do you have to renegotiate? The arrogance of Trump. It's just amazing. I mean, yes, the original deal that Obama negotiated was horrible. But after you've negotiated it, you can't say, well, I didn't like it. And take it back. You've given them their money.
Do-overs.
You've given them. And in the process, by the way, you gave them Iraq.
Yeah, already.
Yeah, you already gave them Iraq.
And serial by default, by connection.
I mean, the only thing that you could do that would be a threat to Iran today that would cause Iran to be willing to negotiate is to say, if you don't renegotiate, now that we have, by the way, we sold Saudi Arabia another $30 billion worth of weapons. This was the THAAD missile defense program this time.
Mm-hmm.
So they can bomb Israel with impunity should they wish to. The only thing that you can do now to renegotiate a deal with Iran is to say, if you don't, we will continue to supply Saudi Arabia with many, many hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons, and we'll tell them, go ahead and use them on Iran. We don't care. That's all you got. And so if you have Iran or Syria, I mean, not Syria, you have Saudi Arabia, go in and declare war on and start sending missiles, American missiles and bombs into Iran. What do you think is going to happen to the Middle East? You think invading Iraq was bad. You think invading Afghanistan was bad. You think that invading Syria was bad. You think that bombing Libya was bad. You ain't seen nothing until you have Saudi Arabia and Iran go at it with a conflict between Soviet and American weapons, pitting the United States and Europe on the side of Saudi Arabia and Russia, China on the side of Iran.
What does that do to the oil business?
The reason that Saudi Arabia started flooding the market with oil was principally to do one thing, and that is to hit the Iranians in a vulnerable position where if the Iranians, who are now free to sell their oil on world markets after their nuclear agreement, that nuclear treaty, if oil was depressed in price and it fell, by five times, from $100 a barrel to $20 a barrel, if oil is depressed in price, then the Iranians will not have the financial wherewithal to arm themselves to a point where they would be successful in a battle against Saudi Arabia. That was Saudi Arabia's calculus.
Yeah.
So if you were to preclude Iran from selling its oil, not only the supply and demand shift in favor of prices going to go up, but at that point, the oil exporters like Saudi Arabia would have no reason to continue to supply large quantities, and the price of oil and gas will go back up to $100 a barrel. I don't know why Trump claims to be smart, why they can't think these things through.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have to claim it, then, we don't deserve it.
No, the other thing that is odd to me, too, is that the United States wants to dictate to Iran and North Korea that they cannot have nuclear weapons. And how many do we have?
More than the rest of the world combined?
Yeah, that would make us a hypocrite, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. We do it for our security, so-called.
Right.
Russia does it for their security. Why wouldn't they?
India got nuclear weapons, so Pakistan got them as a deterrent against India. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia has nuclear weapons. Who's Saudi Arabia's pretty principal enemy? It's not, although they just despise Israel. Saudi Arabia's principal enemy is Iran. So Iran wants nuclear weapons to counteract the nuclear weapons in Saudi Arabia. That's just the way it goes. North Korea, thanks to the Trumpster and others, has determined the United States is their great foe. The United States has nuclear weapons. They have to have nuclear weapons to oppose the United States. The nature of man, isn't it?
Yeah. We just escalate till we become the fall.
Yeah. I watched a program. It was on the Science Channel. And they were talking about finding giants on Earth. Now, of course, every picture of these giant skulls and giant skeletons, they're all internet hosted. They're Photoshop. And they admitted they were all Photoshop. They showed them, and then they admitted they were Photoshop. And then they said, well, you know, our search is justified because the Bible specifically speaks of Nephilim. And the whole show on the Science Channel was about Nephilim and how they were giants of men. Isn't that when this chapter, chapter 10 that we've been doing in this show, mm-hmm. we've been talking yeah. about the fall, does that mean giants?
No. Nope. Nothing about the word means giants.
Oh, God. And they were having this, that these spiritual beings, you know, had sex with earthly women, and they created these giants, and we should look for them because, the evidence exists that they existed. No, they didn't. Homo sapiens can't be giants. Our frame doesn't allow it. It just absolutely yeah. breaks down, and there's no yeah. archaeological evidence whatsoever that they existed, and the Bible does not speak of them, and it really is sad when the Science Channel will misrepresent what God said.
Add
them to the list. God, it's frustrating.
Oh, what a world.
The Science Channel is the place you thought you could go to get away from. I'm not even watching NFL games anymore. I can't stand the politics of it. Where do you go now? For entertainment, besides Yahweh. That's all I've been doing here recently.
I was reading that. Your last stuff, some of your last stuff is really funny. I mean,
yeah.
And I had not thought, I only just, I've read about 2-3 pages of the one you sent me today, 16,
yeah.
but the,
there are some funny steps.
Yeah.
There's no question about that.
Yeah, so, but it's just, you're right. Yeah, it was just entertaining as all get out.
He is funny.
When it's translated right, you get the real story. You go, wow.
Yeah, I know. He's really funny. Yeah, no question about it.
He's got my kind of humor.
Yeah,
it's sarcasm.
Yeah. What he does with Paul is just hilarious.
Oh, I know. It's just
oh, lonely a little.
Oh, yes. It's totally sarcasm. But sarcasm with a point. I love it. That's why I, like Roy had sent me a... some wonderful additions to chapter 15, and I just I've started them again this evening because I finally finished the rough draft of the initial draft anyway of 16. But I was hooked on it. I mean, I was each new word was addictive. I mm-hmm. couldn't pull myself away from it. It was Eliyahu's approach. Was so in your face, so funny, so mocking, so sarcastic.
I can't wait to read this now.
Oh.
Well,
and then there's
you're
going
to send us that thing on JB about Canaanite, right?
Where did you find that? I want to read those.
Oh, it's in chapter 16. That's how I ended up going to Kings 18, is because it was the confrontation between the Canaanite religion of Baal and Yahweh. And
they only have about 62 pages, is it?
I thought it was 70 pages, but
I got 62 in the first pass.
Oh yeah, maybe it's the one I sent you this evening. I sent you one this evening, and I think the one I sent you this evening, if I can open it up again, the latest version of it is, which is, I've now made it to the end. It needs to be proofread, but let's just see how long it is. Oh, yeah, I guess you're right. It's let's see. It takes it a while to bring up all the pages.
The first one you gave me is 62, but it has some other stuff, some notations at the end, so I knew it went over. I just
here it is, 73 pages.
We'll print the other few pages.
Yeah. And it has, in the 73 pages, and it, by the way, it hasn't been edited by anybody. So I'm sure it's rife with typos. But... of those 73 pages, probably 5 or 6 are citations from the Canaanite scriptures.
Yeah.
And with some commentary as to how almost every aspect of the Canaanite scripture sets up and mirrors
Christianity.
Setting the groundwork for what became Christianity.
Yeah, I can't wait to read that.
That's
really freaky. The reason I came to it is because there's a mention of the in Yashaya 8, which was the chapter of Yashaya. That's where it begins. It's Yashaya 8. And there's a mention in Yashaya 8 of wayward souls chasing after Shikar. And I turned to the theological word book, and they mentioned that Shikar was specifically discussed in the Tel Shamra tablets. I'd never heard of the Tel Rosh Shamra tablets. Never heard of them. And so I Googled them. And then, you know, and I found a little snippet here and there. And then finally, about the 10th time that I began to refine my search, I actually found the entirety of the religious presentation of those tablets and the whole history of the God's development and what was specifically written about the religion of the Canaanites in their own hand. So I was just mesmerized by it. I just continued convey it because, you know, throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, Yahweh was constantly condemning a religion that sounded to me like it was the basis of Christianity.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with Rabbinic Judaism. The religion he was condemning had all of the doctrines of Christianity. And, you know, I knew that it had to be an actual religion that was present at that time. And yet, he wasn't saying it for that time because the Canaanites don't exist, so it doesn't have any value.
That
it had to be something that would be manifest in a big way later. And so, you know, here's using all these terms, and then I find that every single one of them, from Astarte, she's part of it. Baal the Lord plays the biggest role in it. El is the name of the god of it. Death and, you know, resurrection cult, a mother of God, a queen of heaven, a trinity. It's all there. Conquering death and dying and conquering death, being resurrected to emerge as the Savior. The Son replacing God the Father in the cult. And it's all there. I thought it was fascinating. But yeah, it's in that it's in the 16th chapter.
I know what I'll be doing this weekend.
So at this point, I'd love your constructive criticism. So as you read it, please, by all means. Yeah. Oh, you know what I forgot to do that I was going to do in it too? Kirk, you'll catch me on this. You wrote me all that additional stuff on the migration of the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
It actually fits better into the 16th chapter than it did into the 14th. Before we publish it here, I'll go back and add it. You'll come to the point where he's talking about the dispersion of the Israelites.
Israel.
By the way, it also works. It also works in Yashaya 8, and it works in particularly as God is saying, it's going to be 7,000 as a remnant.
Hmm. Wow. Okay.
So there's lots of places where it works. So I've yet to work that out. Your stuff is interesting, but it's not quite as interesting as what the boss
does. It just ties up some loose ends to me. I mean, where'd they go? Who are they?
You're interesting.
I got to come back and get closer now. I got to know where they are. So.
Yeah.
But I think
you're interesting. I love your research. It's fun to it's fun to learn from.
I'm not that smart.
But, I have been kind of addicted to the boss here.
Yeah, I've kind of got to want to find you.
Well, I put mine down to read yours, so.
Yeah, he has. He has my attention.
Yeah. That's quite all right.
Yeah, well, I need to let you go. I'm getting a little hungry. I'm feeling
Good night. Happy Shabbat.
Okay, guys. Y'all be safe. And Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shalom.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.